The Kingdom of Silence. "This is a newspaper?" I asked the cab driver in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, as he pulled up in front of the lavish new headquarters of Okaz, the most popular paper in the kingdom. I had expected the usual dingy fire trap that characterizes newspaper offices all over the world, but this building loomed over the humble neighborhood like a royal palace. Workmen were still laying marble tiles on the steps as I entered a towering atrium. Envious reporters for other newspapers call Okaz's new headquarters the Taj Mahal. Saudi men solemnly passed by, wearing crisp white robes and red-checked headscarves. I felt out of place and underdressed. Newspapers are a surprisingly good business in a country where the truth is so carefully guarded. Members of the royal family, Al Saud, are obsessively concerned about their image. They own or control most of the Saudi press, which dominates the Arab world. Within the kingdom, there are more than a dozen papers on the newsstands every morning. The most authoritative of them, and the most progressive, Al-Hayat and Asharq Al-Awsat, are owned by Saudi princes, but published in London. They are constrained by the same taboos that cripple all Saudi publications, however. Nothing provocative can be said about Islam, the government, or the royal family. Another paper, Al-Watan, partly owned by Prince Bandar bin Khalid, models itself on USA Today. But Okaz remains the national favorite. On the coffee table in the lobby was a copy of that morning's edition, January 28, 2003. It was like an Arabic version of the New York Post, filled with Hollywood gossip and stories of jinns who haunt the sand dunes. Although ostensibly independent, Okaz is closely identified with Prince Naif bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud, the Minister of Interior, who also controls the secret police and the media. Up a flight of stairs, in a modest wing by itself, is the Saudi Gazette, an English-language daily published by Okaz, which had hired me for 3 months to help train young Saudi reporters. The job offered me a way of getting into the kingdom after more than a year of fruitless attempts to get a visa as a journalist. Working at the Gazette would also give me a vantage on the Saudi press, which had struggled for a decade to liberate itself from the bonds of government control. In 1990, just before the Gulf War, the media was forced to wait a week before reporting on Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. Meantime, satellite news coverage leaped borders, as did the internet. The press gained a measure of freedom. Suddenly, there were stories about crime, drug use, divorce, even the presence of AIDS in the kingdom. For the first time, Saudis were taking a critical look at their country and its problems. But after September 11th, the media retreated. As a result, it largely missed the biggest story in the kingdom's modern history, blinding itself to the danger within its own society. Walking around the Gazette, I soon found Dr. Mohammed Shukani, the deputy editor-in-chief, sitting in a dim office overlooking the newsroom. There was a television in one corner, and a Mexican soap opera was playing on mute. Like most Saudi men, he wore a white thobe, a shirt-like gown that reached his ankles. His headscarf, called a gutra, was folded on the couch, but he wore the white skullcap that goes under it, which gave him a pastoral air. He was a stocky man, with a round face and a narrow salt-and-pepper mustache. At heart, he was an academic, not a newsman, and he taught courses in English literature at King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah. As we talked, It seemed to me that his eyes were almost retractable, receding into slitted boredom when the subject was not of interest to him. Then, bulging with excitement when he was fully engaged, as when he told me about his great passion, Joseph Conrad. Some of the characters in his early stories come from the Hadramaut, which is where the Bin Ladens come from, Shukani said. Also, in Lord Jim, there is one of the earliest mentions in literature of a Wahhabi preacher. Conrad is definitely a man of our time. Shukani assumed that I had come to the country with a set of stereotypes about Saudis. All we ask is that you judge us on our own terms, Shukani said. He led me through the newsroom, where two dozen editors and typesetters, most of them Indian expatriates, were working on Apple G4s. I could see layouts for the next morning's paper on the screens. The readership of the Gazette is drawn largely from the millions of foreign workers, like these editors, who do much of the essential labor in the kingdom, from driving cabs to manning the oil fields. World and national news is at the front of the paper, with separate pages for the Indian subcontinent and the Philippines, where most of the expats come from. There is also a culture section, a sports page, primarily soccer and cricket, business news, and editorials. Most of the international news comes from wire services. On Friday, Islam's holy day, there is a page on Islamic teachings. In a side room, at a long library table, four translators from Sudan were scanning the daily Arabic press for usable stories. One of them wore a white turban, and another had tribal scars on his cheeks. A Yemeni and a couple of Bangladeshi tea boys in brown uniforms patrolled the floor. Beyond the main newsroom, behind a long wall of glass, the local reporters were waiting to meet me. I sensed the lethargy as soon as I entered the room. Cigarette smoke combined with a fluorescent pall to create a dense subterranean atmosphere. Three young Saudi reporters greeted me with expressions that appeared welcoming but puzzled. We sat down, and I asked them to tell me about themselves. There were two reporters named Hassan Bazwaid and Hassan Hatrash, but they were strikingly different. Bazwaid, 34, was tall and broad-shouldered, with sideburns and curly black hair and omnipresent earphones for his mobile phone, which rang every few minutes, playing the theme from Mission Impossible. He wore jeans and a partly buttoned, untucked white shirt. His handsome face belonged on the cover of a romance novel. Hatresh, 28, was slight and short. He wore traditional Saudi clothes, a trim black goatee, and black glasses that tended to be at half-mast on his nose. Under his headscarf, however, there was a snaky mass of dreadlocks. At heart, Hatresh said, he was a musician, but that was a hopeless career choice in such a puritanical society. Both men had been working at the Gazette for several years. The third reporter, Mamdou Al-Harthi, had joined the staff only about an hour before I arrived. How do you like working here? I asked them. The two Hassans shrugged and looked away. Maybe we can talk about this later, man, Hatrash said. It was several weeks before I learned why he had a West Indian accent. He had honed his English by listening to Bob Marley songs. The serendipitous assignment of training young reporters, I may as well confess, thrilled me. I suspected that behind the closed gates of Saudi society, there was a social revolution in the making. With some guidance, I thought, these journalists could help inspire change. Confronted with the demoralized reporters in my charge, however, I didn't know where to begin. My duties were vague, I was to mentor the reporters by hanging around the office for part of each day and teach them some elementary techniques of investigative journalism. "Don't expect too much," Shukani had warned me. "You can assign them stories. Do whatever you want. You have complete freedom." I wondered what he meant by that. My first big task was to help the local reporters cover the 2003 Hajj, which began in February. Each year at the end of the Islamic calendar, more than 2 million pilgrims arrive in Jeddah on their way to Mecca, 40 miles to the east. It is the largest annual human gathering in the world, and also the biggest event for the local press to cover. Competition for stories is fierce. The Gazette was sending 4 reporters, most of the male staff, to cover it. Hassan Hatrash would lead the team. In the past, the Hajj has been the scene of numerous tragedies, stampedes, fires, air crashes, bombings, bloody riots, and epidemics. The pilgrims, coming from all over the world, invariably bring with them assorted viruses and bacteria, and by the time this Hajj started, on February 9th, there had already been outbreaks of influenza and meningitis in the kingdom. Hatrash wasn't worried, though. He told me that he ensured his immunity by eating small green native lemons. "They protect me against everything," he said. The expectation of war in Iraq made this Hajj especially tense. If the war began before the pilgrims got home, they could be stranded for months. The Saudi government's ambiguous attitude toward the Iraq crisis, officially condemning it, but allowing American forces to use Saudi bases as a staging area for search and rescue missions, left the kingdom open to political demonstrations by Muslims who opposed the war. The government, remembering disasters of the past, was determined to squelch any such dissent. One of the most significant moments in modern Saudi history came at the end of the 1979 Hajj. Several hundred Islamist radicals, many of them students, took over the Grand Mosque in Mecca, using the holiest spot in Islam as a forum for challenging the authority of the royal family. King Khalid obtained a fatwa from the clergy permitting government troops to retake the mosque. 2 weeks of savage hand-to-hand combat in the underground chambers of the holy site left 127 Saudi soldiers dead and more than 450 injured. French commandos provided the Saudis with an unspecified non-lethal gas. When that failed to flush out the terrorists, Saudi forces drilled holes into the chambers and dropped hand grenades through. Amazingly, 170 rebels survived. 63 of them were beheaded in the largest mass execution in Saudi history. This year, as many as half the pilgrims would be women, the highest percentage ever. But curiously, the Gazette was not sending any female reporters to cover the event. According to Shukani, I was supposed to have 3 women under my supervision, but after a week at the paper, I still had not met them. By then, I had spotted a sign on the first floor, behind the stairwell, marked "Ladies Section." I had no idea who, if anyone, was behind the door. Shukani assured me that female reporters were allowed to attend meetings in the conference room. And yet, they missed the first session I called, at 4 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. "I learned they go home early," Shukani said, apologetically. The following day, with the meeting set for an hour earlier, 3 black-shrouded figures slipped into the Gazette conference room. Once they were seated, the male reporters followed, arraying themselves on the opposite side of the table. I sat awkwardly at the head. The women were all in black abayas and hijabs, the obligatory robes and headscarves, and one of them veiled her face as well, with only a pair of cat-eye glasses peeking out from the mask of black cloth. Hanging from her chair was an alligator purse with a long gold chain. The self-effacement of an entire sex, and consequently of sexuality itself, was the most unnerving feature of Saudi life. I could go through an entire day without seeing any women, except perhaps some beggars sitting on the curb outside a prince's house. Almost all public space, from the outdoor terrace at the Italian restaurant to the sidewalk tables at Starbucks, belonged to men. The restaurants had separate entrances for families and bachelors, and I could hear women scurrying past, hidden by screens, as they went upstairs or to a rear room. The only places I was sure to see women were at the mall or the grocery store, and even there they seemed spookily out of place. Many of them wore black gloves, and their faces were covered entirely, like canary cages. Not even a pair of plummy, heavy-lidded Arabian eyes apparent. Sometimes I couldn't tell what direction they were facing. It felt to me as if the women had died, and only their shades remained. The reporter with the alligator purse was named Najla Fathi. It was a surprise to learn that Najla and her female colleagues were far better educated than the men on the staff, most of whom had not finished college. Najla, for instance, had obtained a master's degree in political science from the University of Louisville in 1995. "And I haven't been outside the Arab world since," she declared. Her tone suggested anger or defiance, or even an attempt at humor. But it was maddeningly difficult to read her intentions without access to her facial expressions. She was a riddle to me. I wanted to get the Gazette reporters, like Najla, started on investigative stories while Hatrash and his team were covering the Hajj. There was one piece I was particularly keen on. In March 2002, a fire had broken out in the 31st Girls' Middle School in Mecca, a dilapidated four-story building that held 835 students and 55 teachers. According to initial reports, the fire had begun in the kitchen at about 8 in the morning, creating panic. The only exit was locked. An elderly guard had wandered away with the key. 15 girls were trampled to death. More than 50 others were injured, some having jumped from the windows. According to eyewitnesses, a number of people had rushed to put out the blaze, but they were turned away by a representative of the Commission for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice, the country's religious police, because the girls were not wearing their abayas. The director of the commission denied these accounts. Female education, which was introduced in 1960, was born in controversy. Although females now outnumber males at the university level, only 6% of women in the overall population are employed, a statistic that has led religious conservatives to argue that education is wasted on girls. After the fire, the head of the General Presidency for Girls' Education announced that it had been God's will. He said this at a press conference at which he awarded each reporter in the room an expensive lambskin briefcase. I was told that he was later photographed surveying the ruins of the school in his ministerial robes. The pictures captured him stepping absent-mindedly on the abayas that had been left behind. But it was the detail about the religious police blocking the rescue of the girls that sent the country into a paroxysm of introspection. Ever since the 1979 attack on the Grand Mosque, the Mutawa, as these government-subsidized vigilantes are informally called, have become a far more invasive presence in the country. The lesson the royal family had drawn from that traumatic attack was that it could protect itself from religious extremists only by empowering them. The Mutawa prowl restaurants and shopping malls and amusement parks, making sure that businesses have closed for prayer time and chastising women whose attire fails to meet their standards of modesty. They have been known to shoot up satellite dishes and break into private homes. The Mutawa are usually trailed by official policemen who are at their command. The Saudi press made history by writing about the fire without first asking the Ministry of Information for permission. For several weeks, the government stood aside and simply let the press be free. "When will we ever be ashamed of our attitude towards women?" the editor of Al Riyadh asked his readers. "We ascribe all of society's ills to them. Does the Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice care about our wives, sisters, mothers, and daughters more than we do?" The Gazette, which rarely criticized the government, demanded an investigation of the religious police and prosecution of those responsible for the deaths of the girls. By Saudi standards, the coverage was so relentless that even reformists were troubled. Eventually, the Interior Minister summoned the editors-in-chief of all the newspapers in the country and told them that the stories must stop. They immediately did. For Saudi journalists, the drama over the girls' school was both liberating and disconcerting. It confirmed that the Saudi press could play a dissenting role, but some said that ultimately the story had proved to be a setback. The government sharply reduced the zone of freedom because it had been so alarmed by the popular fury the story had unleashed. Near the end of the Thursday meeting, I suggested assigning a one-year anniversary story about the event. I wanted a woman reporter to write it. "The question is, after a year, have things really changed?" I asked. "Of course they have," Najla said impatiently, leaning on the table with what must have been her chin resting on her fist. "Everybody knows this. The head of the General Presidency for Girls' Education was fired. They merged that department into the Ministry of Education." "To me, they seem like symbolic changes," I said. "The girls died because they were locked inside a ramshackle, overcrowded building with no fire escapes. Is the government actually building safe schools for girls? Are the teachers conducting fire drills? Are girls still locked inside?" One of the women, Sabahat Siddiqui, shyly spoke up. "I will do this story, if you will tell me how," she said. I suggested that Sabahat talk to civil defense authorities to see if they had improved fire safety, and to the Minister of Education to determine if the government had followed through on its pledge to build safe schools. I advised her to go to Mecca and talk to the families of the girls who died. She should visit girls' schools in Jeddah and talk to women educators to see whether they were satisfied with the government's response. Sabahat nodded and earnestly took notes, but Najla laughed. "That's not the way things work here," she warned me. While Hatrash and his Hajj team were in Mecca, I took time to drive around Jeddah. I rented a Hyundai with 57,000 kilometers on it and dents on every panel, including the roof. The traffic was frightening. "We have the highest number of accidents in the world, and we don't even have alcohol," Hatrash had told me. He attributed the accident rate to the high level of stress in Saudi society, which also contributes to extraordinary rates of diabetes and high blood pressure in the kingdom. Every time a signal turned green, There would be drivers in the far right lane turning left across six lanes, and drivers in the left-hand lane going straight, and then we would all speed like dragsters to the next light. Jeddah is an ancient city that displays almost no evidence of the past. In the old quarter, houses made of coral brick with latticed balconies are crumbling from neglect. Buildings that fell decades ago are still rubble. Outside this small historical district, one enters what could be a seedy suburb of Houston, with familiar American franchises lining potholed boulevards. Despite the wealth of the Bin Laden clan, Osama bin Laden grew up in a working-class neighborhood called Al-Amariya, where laundry dries on the balconies and shopkeepers chat on the stoops. Later, he moved with his mother and his stepfather to a new neighborhood. They lived in a modest white villa on Jabal al-Arab Street, with a filigree iron gate and a small courtyard. In 1984, when Osama took a second wife, he bought a run-down apartment house off Macaroni Street, so named because of an old pasta factory nearby. At night, teenagers cruise Palestine Street, one of Jeddah's main thoroughfares, which begins in the desert hills on the east side of town and ends at the Red Sea. On the beach, families picnic and go for camel rides and sport about in fanciful neon-lit donkey carts. Between the beach and a spit of land that holds the king's summer royal palace, a majestic fountain spouts 853 feet into the air, making it the tallest in the world. Jeddah also boasts the world's largest Chuck E. Cheese's pizza parlor. Everything of value that Saudi Arabia produces, i.e., oil, comes out of the eastern province on the other side of the country, where supertankers ply the Persian Gulf on their way to refueling the industrial world. The Jeddah Islamic seaport, on the other hand, is devoted almost entirely to imports. Food, clothing, appliances, furniture, and electronics, which fill the stores in this highly consuming but notoriously unproductive society. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was founded, in its modern incarnation, in 1932 by Abdulaziz ibn Abdul Rahman Al Saud. The first oil boom hit in the early 50s, and soon desert nomads were docking their yachts in Monaco and renting entire floors of the Ritz. By 1981, per capita income was more than $28,000, about equal to that of the United States at the time. Saudi Arabia seemed to be on the way to becoming the richest nation in history, the global landlord. Oil prices have fluctuated since then, but when I arrived in the kingdom, oil was at $30 a barrel, and the Saudi per capita income was less than $7,000, around that of Mexico. Statistics in the kingdom are rarely more than guesses. An employee at the Jeddah Chamber of Commerce and Industry cheerfully told me, "At the chamber, we cook our own figures." The oil wealth of the country runs first through royal pockets. Various businessmen and economists speculate that the Saud family skims off as much as 30% or 40%. "We build $40 million palaces for even minor princes," an architect told me. Those closest to the crown are staggeringly wealthy. Abdulaziz bin Fahd, a son of King Fahd, is in his early 30s. And his wealth alone could solve the entire unemployment problem of Saudi Arabia. Mohsen Alawaji, a lawyer and spokesman for Wahhabi dissidents, told me, "There are billions upon billions in his account. Nobody can challenge him. Nobody can ask the royal family why." The royal family includes everyone related to the founder, King Abdulaziz, and his brother or his cousins. That's about 30,000 people, according to Princess Reem Al-Faisal, a photographer in Jeddah. Titles in Europe were often connected to political positions, she observed. Here, anybody from Al Saud is called a prince. It is more like the Irish clans. You can say we are like the O'Briens. There are thousands of us. Still, with Saudi Arabia containing one-fourth of the world's known oil reserves, the government has no need to tax its citizens. Education and health care are free, but there is little evidence of public wealth or philanthropy. As I explored the kingdom, I noticed few parks or playgrounds or museums. There are not enough universities or private schools to serve the population. Practically no research institutions, few public arts groups, and no human rights organization. Muslims are supposed to give 2.5% of their savings and investments each year to the poor, an offering called the zakat. Much of it is given out directly as Ramadan gifts to the needy, or else poured into Islamic charities. The government does not like to be outdone in spending money, a Jeddah businessman told me. That might provide for a cult of personality not tied to the royal family. The only thing you can do in this country with your money is to build a mosque. And we have enough mosques, for crying out loud. God forbid you should open an orphanage. The fact that there are no secular charities or non-governmental institutions, or, of course, political parties, civil society, in other words, means that there is no moderate, stabilizing middle ground between the government and the clerics. This situation has inevitably elevated the power of religious conservatives. Although many of the country's own citizens struggle to make do, the Saudi government sends about $2 billion a year in aid to other Islamic countries, building mosques and madrasas, underwriting religious universities, distributing books and tracts, funding charities, and supporting jihad. These donations, approved by the small inner circle of elderly princes who run the government, are made with an eye toward placating the country's religious extremists. They also ensure that the Wahhabi strain of Sunni Islam, the official dogma of the kingdom, will be the Muslim voice heard above all others. Life in the kingdom changed after the 1979 attack on the Grand Mosque. The newly empowered Wahhabi clerics waged war on art and the pleasures of the intellect. Music was the first victim. Kulthum and Feruz, the songbirds of the Arab world, disappeared from the Saudi television stations. A magnificent concert hall in Riyadh was completed in 1989, but no performance has ever been held there. The Islamic courts have even banned the music played when a telephone call is placed on hold. There had been some movie theaters, but they were all shut down. Meantime, religion has steadily increased its dominance of the Saudi school curriculum, so students have correspondingly less exposure to science, art, and languages. Dr. Nahed Taher is a senior strategic economist at the largest bank in the Middle East, the National Bank of Commerce, the first woman to occupy that position. She pointed out that the population of the country has been growing at twice the rate of the economy for the past 20 years. The unemployment problem is aggravated by an educational system that produces more and more unqualified graduates. 45% of our graduates have degrees in Islamic studies or literature, she observed. Also, 55% of our graduates are females, but they make up only 5% of the labor force. My kid is in the fifth grade, Omar Bagur, a columnist for Al-Madina, and a professor of economics at King Abdulaziz University told me. Out of 12 subjects, 7 are pure religion. You tell me a system of this nature is going to bring into the labor force a highly qualified Saudi? Bullshit. The religious establishment, however, wants education to become even more Islamic. Educational systems of atheist nations and civilizations cannot be like the systems of a believing nation, Sa'ala ibn Humayd, a Saudi cleric, warned. This country represents the power of Islam. Any attempt to change this status will be vehemently opposed. The religious establishment makes sure that millions of Islamic books are translated into other languages each year, but very few books are translated into Arabic. Censorship of books is more rigid now than 40 years back. Muhammad Salahuddin, a columnist for Al-Madina, told me one night at dinner. Back then, I could buy a copy of Das Kapital in Mecca. Now you cannot dream of finding such books. Although there are several popular Saudi painters in the kingdom, the Wahhabi ban on the representation of human beings or animals makes for geometric abstractions and unpeopled landscapes, a studied avoidance of the real. There was even a cultural war over the Starbucks logo, a mermaid. The religious police complained about the emblem when the company opened its first store in Riyadh in 2000. Under pressure, Starbucks changed its logo. Government authorities eventually overruled the complaint, deciding that mermaids are neither human nor animal, but mythological. By the time I got to Jeddah, the mermaid was back on the company's signs. One evening, in Riyadh, I went to the National Museum after evening prayers. It is a spectacular building, made of Arabian limestone and designed by the Canadian firm Moriyama and Teshima to resemble the gently bending wall of a desert wadi. I walked through the vast exhibition halls, alone, except for one Saudi couple and their young daughter. I could hear their footsteps echoing just behind me, and their voices hushed in the emptiness. The display cases told the history of the Arabian Peninsula, from the dinosaurs and the early petroglyphs to the triumphant arrival of Islam. Eerily absent from the exhibit were representations of the people who lived there. I suppose that was why there were so few visitors in the museum. It was a story with no characters. In one of the grand halls, I noticed an odd cul-de-sac under a stairwell, where I found a painting of a human face, the only one in the museum. It was a wall drawing from the village of Al-Fayo, from the 2nd or 3rd century AD, depicting a man with a garland around his curly hair. It looked like a Roman Christian icon. At that time, Jews and Christians were making inroads among the polytheists of the peninsula. The man had wide, round eyes, like the figures in the frescoes of Pompeii. It was a tribute to the importance of this miniature portrait that it was displayed at all. Still, that it was hidden under the stairs, almost as if it were pornography, made me admire, as never before, the power of the human form. One day, in Jeddah, I went across town to see Jamal Khashoggi, who was then the deputy editor of the Arab News, the main English-language competitor of the Saudi Gazette. We met in his office. He is a tall man with a trim beard and a pale, moon-shaped face. He had covered the Afghan jihad sympathetically and had been a friend of bin Laden's, but he had rejected the Islamist movement when it turned toward terror. After September 11th, He was practically the only Saudi journalist who addressed the cultural failures within Saudi society that had contributed to the tragedy. "Despite the enormity of what happened, we are still in denial," he wrote a year after the event. "We still cling to unlikely conspiracy theories and eye the truth with suspicion. The most pressing issue now is to ensure that our children can never be influenced by extremist ideas, like those 15 Saudis who were misled into hijacking 4 planes on that fine September day, piloting them and us straight into the jaws of hell." After tea had been served, Khashoggi and I began talking about the term schizophrenic, which many Saudis use to characterize the quality of their lives. Khashoggi said it referred to the split between what he called virtual Saudi Arabia and real Saudi Arabia. "The virtual Saudi Arabia actually exists in its rules and in the minds of the people," he told me. "For instance, in virtual Saudi Arabia, there is no satellite television. In principle and by law, you are not allowed to own a satellite dish. But in reality, we are the biggest consumers of satellite television in the Middle East. Not only that, Saudi businessmen are also the biggest investors in satellites. In principle and by law, Saudi Arabia is not supposed to have interest-based banking. But in fact, 90% of our banking system is interest-based." And it goes on and on. "The solution for Saudi problems is to bring the virtual world and the real world together." I asked Khashoggi what role the press could play in the country's efforts to change. "I don't think the press can play a role," he told me. "I don't see a single paper calling for reform. The papers are not structured in a way to make that possible. Every editor-in-chief is ultimately approved by the Minister of Interior, who is also in charge of the country's secret police." Khashoggi pointed to a broad petition for reform that had been put forward in February 2003 by 104 Saudi intellectuals. Crown Prince Abdullah, the de facto ruler of the country, had received the signers warmly, but not a single newspaper had published their list of demands. "The limits of press freedom were always changing," Khashoggi explained. "We are pushing the boundaries, but at the same time being cautious," he said. "Now it's accepted that we can get on the toes of the mayor, but not those of the governor." Later, I met with Hussein Shobokshi, a columnist for Okaz, and a wealthy building contractor who embodies the progressive, often American-educated business community. He graduated from the University of Tulsa. Shobokshi was a member of the board of trustees of the private female college in Jeddah. He is a good-looking man with large, sleepy eyes and a wry sense of humor. His father was head of Okaz and the founder of the Saudi Gazette, and Hussein is a major stockholder. He told me that there had been some progress in press freedom in the past decade. "Now we don't get locked up because of what we say. We get locked up because of what we do." The girls' school story, Shobokshi said, was a very important dialogue between the government and the press, but there is no new cause célèbre. If you were trying to point young reporters to one story that could shake the country, what would it be? I asked him. "Sewage," he answered emphatically. 20 years ago, Shobokshi told me, Jeddah had been provided with the money to build a modern sewage system that would accommodate the fast-growing city. The government official in charge of the project, however, took the money and built himself a mansion in San Francisco and a palace in Jeddah that is equipped with a discotheque and a bowling alley. As a result, Shobokshi said, the streets in Jeddah are constantly filled with tanker trucks to drain the city's cesspools. Worse, sewage has got mixed into Jeddah's groundwater. and this has contaminated drinking water in many parts of the city. We have new diseases of the eye and skin that didn't exist here 10 years ago, Shibokshi said. Lung and breast cancers are 40% above the national rate. Hepatitis is so high that it has to be classified as an epidemic. Marine biologists tell me that certain fishes have become extinct because of the overflow. Swimming will be history. Shibokshi said that he had traveled to Delft University of Technology in Holland for advice. I gave them all the figures. They told me, Hussein, you've got a time bomb. The sewage right now is dumped in a huge lake above the city. The walls of this lake are made of sand, and Jeddah is on a geological fault. They said that if there's an earthquake of 5 on the Richter scale, it will take 6 hours for the entire city of Jeddah to be flooded with sewage water, 1.5 meters deep. What happened to the guy who stole the money? The government investigated, and it was ruled that he should pay a penalty and go to jail, Shibokshi said. But then he was pardoned, because his brother is the private secretary to the king. Shibokshi confided that he was initiating what he called the first ever class action lawsuit in the kingdom. He was gathering 5,000 signatures and had hired 10 young lawyers to prepare the case. Nobody had yet written about the suit in the press, and he agreed that if the Saudi Gazette published a series of stories about the sewage crisis, he would give the paper a scoop about the lawsuit. He had me hooked, and he knew it. This is history, with a capital H, he said. I was handed the draft of an article by Mamdou Alharthi, the new reporter. He was from a prominent Bedouin tribe, but instead of a thobe, he usually dressed in upscale, casual Western clothes, jeans, oversized T-shirt, and sunglasses, with the name of the designer prominently displayed on every item. Chicks notice such things, he advised me. When we went to the mall together, he stopped in his tracks like a bird dog and watched a pair of girls, entirely swathed in black, descending an escalator. Check him out, he said, without irony. Mamdou was a child of the souk. His father owned an elegant shop downtown that sold dates and candies. He had a merchant's facility with languages, speaking Urdu and Turkish, and his English was so colloquial that I never thought to worry about his writing ability. He had been working on a story about the Hajj travel industry. His first draft began. Hundreds of airplanes flying Hajjis to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj. Most of those planes go back with no single passenger, such as the Turkish Airlines. Other airlines claimed they are full occupied. I read through the brief piece, wondering what he could possibly mean by the income is very pen fetal. What do you think, Chief? Mamdou asked. I want you to write this for me in Arabic, I said. No problemo, he said, but he sounded a little puzzled. When he finished, I took his Arabic draft to one of the Sudanese translators. It's excellent Arabic, he told me. I went back to Mamdou. How far did you go in school? I asked. I've got a BA in English literature. That stopped me. Okay, now you're in charge of your own education, I told him. Stop watching girls. Read a book in English. Watch BBC. Rent American movies. Whatever you do, do it in English. In the meantime, write your articles in Arabic first, then translate them. Okay, Chief, he said, but he sounded discouraged. All the reporters had problems writing in English. That was what the Indian editors were there for. The editors could sometimes salvage pieces that were inscrutable to me. Every other week, it seemed, a new reporter came on board, often someone just out of high school. They weren't really expected to produce. Some reporters went weeks without writing a single story, and when they did write one, it might be about an event that had taken place 10 days before. Many mornings, the paper didn't carry any local news at all. I began to wonder if it was an accident that the local reporters were ill-equipped to handle the job. I was heartened, therefore, to read some engaging stories from the Gazette team in Mecca. The tent city of Mina on the outskirts of Mecca is all ready to welcome the pilgrims, the Gazette reported on the eve of the Hajj. 5 hospitals with more than 700 beds were set up. 30,000 butchers, staffing 5 slaughterhouses, were on hand to dispatch hundreds of thousands of sacrificial animals. According to a story filed by Hassan Hatrash, 4,000 Boy Scouts would have new software available to help pilgrims locate their cots among the 44,000 air-conditioned tents that filled the valley like a white-capped sea. Scouts, until recently, used to serve in excess of 10,000 lost pilgrims a day, Hatrash wrote.